Welcome to The PA Is In, the show created by PAs for PAs, where codependency with your supervising physician is a thing of the past, optimal team practice is the future, and physician associate has taken the place of physician assistant as the professional title of choice. I'm Tracy Bingaman, and I'm obsessed with redefining what success as a PA looks like and what it feels like. Here you'll find the mindset shifts, systems, and processes I use to escape healthcare burnout and integrate my work into my life. Work-life balance is a myth, and an integrated life where you thrive professionally, not a balancing act, is the goal here. My mission is to help you to grow into a unicorn PA who loves their job, has abundant energy, time to spare, and work optional financial freedom. The PA is in. If you weren't practicing clinically, what would you be doing? What would interest you? What would be interesting to pursue or try or to see how you could generate income outside the ways of seeing a patient every 15 to 30 minutes? Our guest today, Mike Asbach, is going to share with us how he diversified his life, his career, and his income streams, leveraging the expertise and the skills that he uses every day as an interventional psych PA. Without further ado, here he is, Mike Asbach. Mike, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Hi, yes, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to have a wonderful conversation today.
Awesome. So if you could just take a minute and tell everyone who isn't familiar with you, what you do as a PA and what you do outside of clinical medicine.
Yeah, sure. So my name's Mike Asbach. I'm a psych PA. I've been practicing clinically since 2012, so past 10 years, which is kind of mind-blowing because I know usually the definition of early career is 10 years. So I'm no longer early career and I'm having trouble with that. But in my day job, I work as a psych PA at Dent Neurologic Institute. I run an interventional psych program. So we do hands-on psychiatry, including IV ketamine, intranasal esketamine, and then transcranial magnetic stimulation. And we are hopefully going to be doing other fun stuff such as psychedelics and all the other fun things that are coming down the pike. Outside of my day job, I spend about half my time these days doing a lot of consulting. So in any given year, I do about 100 educational talks for the pharmaceutical industry, medical education industry. And then lately, I've been getting more into like brand and marketing consulting for both medical education and the pharmaceutical industry, helping them understand how to talk to PAs and NPs, because the messaging a lot of times is very different compared to physicians. And thankfully, industry is recognizing that as our profession is coming into the limelight and having our moment, that they also need to directly market and message to them as well.
Awesome. So I want to jump right in and talk about how you have been, you know, sort of strategic about diversifying your career and generating these multiple streams of income. I think that physicians seem to do this a lot better than we do as advanced practice providers. So what has sort of shifted in your life, or what has made it so that you wanted to not just be relying on your clinical income?
I think it's multifold. I agree with you. I think it's something that as PAs, we need to do more of. Physicians are better at it. It's, for me, started with just the mentality that I didn't ever really think that I could do just clinical care for 40 years and feel fulfilled and satisfied by that. So about 5 to 7 years into my career, I started to settle in. Not that I knew everything. There was still so much to learn, but I started to settle in and at least feel like every day I wasn't going to, you know, have a freak out because I didn't know what I was doing. And I started to look around and try and figure out what the next step was, what the next mountain to conquer would be. And recognized at the time, this was 2015, 2016, that industry consulting seemed to be a really interesting thing. My medical director here at Dent, Dr. Capote, who's a mentor, was very instrumental in helping guide me and kind of make some introductions there. But from the start, I realized that I love patient care. I love clinical medicine. But if I was going to see patients in 15 or 20 minute slots to back to back to back to back every single day, it just wears on you. It's a grind emotionally. It's a grind, you know, cognitively. So I wanted an opportunity to diversify my income streams, but also diversify just cognitive load. for every day, different parts of your brain, doing different things that could be more mentally stimulating. So that's kind of how it started. And as it progressed, I've gotten more strategic where, you know, now I try to make sure that if I'm going to take gigs as a consultant, that they're in the same direction of what I'm trying to achieve. Like I said earlier, my 2024 goal is I'm trying to move more towards brand marketing and doing more of the behind the scenes work. So for example, if you go to a CME conference, someone made those slides. And a lot of times there's a whole team of editors and scientific people behind the scenes that are confirming the slides, designing them, making sure that they are readable, making sure that they convey the message that they're meant to convey. And it's a lot of fun to build those because I feel like if I can, you know, help build a really good message that is educationally focused, that you're going to have a huge impact on not just the people that you get to speak to person, but then anyone that may see those slides or may interact with that information. And it really is cool to feel like you're having this outsized impact in medicine.
Yeah, awesome. I think it is, I have said this before, that I think the PA profession is like going through puberty. Like we're growing up, we're sort of coming into our own as a profession. And so I love to hear that companies are calling up people like you and saying, hey, we've been marketing to physicians since the dawn of time. And we realize that they're not the only ones prescribing this med or recommending this device, and that they want to speak the language of advanced practice providers and of people who are differently trained, but similarly, you know, working clinically and taking care of patients. The thing that struck me about when you're saying, hey, I want to diversify the way that my brain is working and the way that I'm showing up in the world, is that I think that is a super key piece of career sustainability that a lot of us are missing. When we do 40 plus hours of patient care a week, when we are on that, you know, hamster wheel of just like next patient charting again, we lose some of that variety. And I do think that that predisposes us to feel burned out or stuck or plateaued, or like we really haven't been growing clinically.
Yeah, completely agree. I couldn't cite the research right now, but there's actually good neuroscience. It might be Huberman, who I am not a Huberman guy, but I'm at least Huberman aware. My business partner, John, is like very into it and won't drink coffee until 2 hours into the day. And that, it just sounds awful. But there's research out there that shows that if you are doing high intensity cognitive engagement for short periods of time, but then varying it up throughout the day, that that's actually how you can maximize productivity and you do best. So sitting down and doing the same task for 8 hours really does not lend itself to peak productivity. Ideally, what you do is you time block. You work on a few projects throughout the day. And in medicine, that's hard. If you worked in a project-based role, if you were an engineer at Lockheed Martin, you may be able to say, okay, I'm going to work on this project now, then this project later. But in medicine, if you're in clinic, yeah, you're seeing different patients, but it's largely the same disease states over and over again with maybe a little bit of a different flair. So it's hard. It's hard to kind of get out of that funk or maybe out of that rhythm. And you'll really put your brain to work where it can be fun, interesting, and engaging.
Yeah. I think as clinicians, we have fallen into this mindset where we are sort of the victim to the template or the victim to what our administrators have said, hey, this is the amount of new patients. This is a new patient slot. This is a follow-up patient slot. And I saw this post the other day that said, I was trying to explain to my friend who works in corporate America what it's like to be in clinic. And it was like, you have 17 meetings. So it was like, you have 17 meetings. You're late for every one of them. Right? You're running behind. There's deliverables that are due at the end of your 15-minute meeting. Like, and it was so funny because my husband works in corporate America and I was like nodding along, like, this is exactly what it feels like to be seeing patients all day, is to just say, oh, here I go again. I have to write a report. I have to write a report. Because charting is really writing a report on what your patient said and what you're planning to do with them, which I don't think we think of as we're sort of going about the diagnosing and treating of our patients.
Yeah, so true. I think it's really quite refreshing when you can get out of that. And there's so many opportunities to do that. I think the most common, if someone's listening to this and maybe they don't know how to break out of the clinical role, just adjunct professorship, I don't know, is that a word? I'm making it up as we go. We'll stick with it. But getting an adjunct faculty role at a school where maybe you're just doing one or two lectures or even just taking over the disease state that you work in, it may not pay the greatest, but it's a really nice change of pace. It allows you to do something different. It allows you to pour back into the next generation of clinicians. And those types of roles are prevalent. If you call your alma mater, I almost guarantee you they would beg for you to come in because they're always looking for people to teach.
Yeah. Or to have students come to you. So if you're not in a position where you want to blow your PTO and going to your local university, I live close to where I went to school. And so those students have Friday morning rotations. So they come to our office on Friday mornings. And the students are always so excited because they've been let out of the classroom, right? It's their, for their first year students, they're like, out, they let us out. And I always look forward to it because there's not a Friday that goes by that a student doesn't ask me a question that I'm like, oh, I've actually never thought of that before, or I don't explain that well to my patients because you just heard me explain it to them and you didn't get it. So what am I doing from an education standpoint to make it so that my patients get it? Because if this student didn't understand how I explain this mechanism of action, probably the patient didn't get it either. So I have found that to be really fulfilling. And, you know, it dovetails well with my clinical work when I'm in the office on Fridays.
Completely agree. And I think you touch on something very important there too, that medicine truly is a field of communication, where almost everything that we do, whether it's education, whether it's clinical, really what makes us effective is not our knowledge base. Certainly you have to have some knowledge. If you are completely incompetent, you won't last long. But the vast majority of what we do, we can find on UpToDate or through Google searches. So really, it's our ability to communicate effectively with the patient, ask the right questions, have the patient feel comfortable to give us the right answers. Because if you are poor in your communication skills, the patient may not feel comfortable to really give an effective or accurate history. So really, so much of our role is driven by how we can communicate, not only with patients, but also with our peers and colleagues.
Yeah. I recently had an experience where I was the patient. So I got appendicitis right before Thanksgiving and ended up in the ER getting seen by a surgery resident who was like, we're going to the OR. And this resident walked in and explained the surgical consent, like just so beautifully. I wanted to record it. Like I felt like I wanted to take a video of her explaining it to me and show it to all of my students. Cause I thought I did surgery for years and I did not once explain a surgery-informed consent as well as she did. She went through each section and she was talking about anesthesia and residents are at the hospital now and everything. It was so detailed. I was like, I would sign anything this woman put in front of me. She was just so good at her communication. And I thought, what a good experience to be, first of all, for it to be good communication that's happening. And second of all, to say, oh, wow, like I was doing that poorly all along and I could have been doing it so much better.
Yeah. And I think that's really what the role of medical education can be. It's not only to provide, you know, latest clinical updates or new features, because medicine's always evolving, but also provide an opportunity for clinicians to learn how to explain complex disease states or how to better understand in turn so that they can help their patients understand.
Thinking of a career shift in 2024, Advanced Scope is one of the only PA consulting firms optimizing your job hunt without taking away from your earning potential. They don't dip into your paycheck and your job search remains 100% confidential at no cost to you. Through partnering with practices nationwide, they know about opportunities before LinkedIn or Indeed even posts them. Connect with their CEO, Madison, today by going to advancedscopetalent.com and booking an exploratory call. Your future career and paycheck will thank you. Absolutely. So I'm curious, I'm sure there are people listening to this who are saying, but I'm not sure if I am in the right place, the right field, if I should have become a PA at all, that they just feel lost and unfulfilled, or like they haven't found their place in healthcare. What advice do you have for that person to sort of try to figure out if this is right for them?
Oh man, how much time do you have? We could make this a 4-hour answer. So I think for people that are feeling uncertain, you know, maybe you recently graduated and now you're settling into your clinical role and it's maybe not what you expected it to be, or maybe you've been doing this for a while, you've been killing it, and it's now starting to feel mundane. I think really there's a fork in the road as we're looking at how to career plan or look forward and project out our career. And one of the questions ends up being is, what do you want to accomplish? And it's interesting because I think society or culture always kind of vacillates back and forth, where right now I think hustle culture is a bad word, where in the 80s and 90s, hustle culture was celebrated. And I would argue probably 15 or 20 years from now, we'll go back to hustle culture being celebrated again. But I think if you were feeling uncertain, the first question would be, what are you looking to get out of your career? Are you looking for your career to be the place that gives you this incredible sense of purpose, fulfillment, economic security? There's a lot of things that you can achieve within a career. And the cool thing with medicine is there's just infinite opportunities to have a job where you can make an incredible difference. I'm going to brag on my wife. She's a PA, and she recently transitioned to a new role where she's working with refugees and immigrants day in and day out. And talk about meaningful work, where every single day she's seeing people that have, you know, crossed hundreds of miles through the desert on foot for a better life and may not have had any medical care in years. So she can, in every single visit, just have this incredible sense of accomplishment where she feels that she's doing some really important work. And healthcare is so full of those opportunities. But the reason I would pause there is I think we sometimes fall into the trap of healthcare of just assuming that everybody has to love what they do. And my grandfather came over after World War II, didn't speak any English. He was a tailor in Europe. Did not work as a tailor in the U.S. at all. Worked factory line, you know, working class. I think when he retired in the 90s, he was making $20,000 a year, which was, you know, a fair wage, but low. And had an incredible life, not because of his career, not because of the work that he did, but because of everything that he did outside of it. He was involved in his church, had a huge, incredible garden, had, you know, good friends, good community. And that's what defined his life. So I think so often in healthcare, we are taught from day one that we need to bleed for our patients, that we need to leave it all on the table. And certainly through COVID, we in some cases had to. But I think if you're feeling unfulfilled, the first step is to figure out where in your life are you looking to find that meaning, purpose, and fulfillment. If you have a job that pays fairly well, which for PA, most of our jobs do, I think it's completely acceptable to say, you know what, I don't need my job to give me warm fuzzies. I don't need my job to fulfill me and make me happy because I make a great wage and I'm going to be content with that wage. And I'm going to find that meaning and purpose through volunteer work, through a great partner and spouse, through kids, whatever it may be. Now, the flip side, though, is if you are someone who is looking for your career to provide more, if you're looking for that opportunity, I would first look at it and question whether it's the problem with the clinical work, because sometimes there's clinical settings that are just not conducive to you feeling satisfied, whether it's a toxic work environment or maybe you're in a job that is just not that interesting. I don't want to rag on any specific specialties, but like occupational health. Man, if I worked in occupational health, I would be very bored very quickly because it sounds awful. And I'm sorry to anyone that's in occupational health that loves what they do.
That's how I feel about medical subspecialties.
Yeah,
I'm like, right. You do medicine? Like, no.
Yeah, everyone's going to have that, you know, because whatever you have found to bring you joy is not going to be the thing that the other person finds either. But first figure out, is this a problem where maybe I'm just mismatched clinically with what I'm doing? Is there something different I can be doing clinically that would be more fulfilling? The next step beyond that is there a way that I can diversify or branch out in my career and find something that maybe would, fulfill that? And I think this is where, just to where we were talking earlier, this is where PAs are thankfully starting to do better, but are still way behind the eight ball compared to other health professions. I think going into industry and being a medical science liaison is an incredible career, well compensated, it demands a lot. You're surrounding yourself with brilliant people within the pharmaceutical or medical device industry. You're helping shape clinical research. You're helping interact and interface with key opinion leaders. It's a great job that probably provides a lot of gratification and enjoyment. So maybe it's something where you need to consider a transition or a pivot to something non-clinical, or maybe you just need to supplement. I think medicine is great where if you're not necessarily feeling the warm fuzzies from your job, but your job pays well and gives you good benefits, then maybe it's just something where you drop a day or two of the week and pick up with medical writing, or you find more gig work that is non-clinical that can fill in the gaps. And there's so many opportunities to do that if you are knowing where to look for them.
Yeah. I find that for me personally, I had to detangle my own identity from being called to work in healthcare because I had started to take on the identity of I'm a PA as part of who I was. Like that was the thing I would say, like, hey, I'm a PA. This is who I am. It's the way that I serve the world. And because medicine is this strange thing where people don't go into medicine for the glory, right? No one became a PA because they thought just, you know, I'm just going to be in the Guinness Book. You know, we went in because we wanted to take care of patients and because we felt called to do it. And I don't think there's out there, I mean, maybe there is, but I don't think there's two plumbers talking on a podcast about how they're just so unfulfilled and they, you know, plumbing is their life's work and they just get so much meaning out of like making sure all the toilets flush. Like it's simply a means to an end for them. It is simply, I go to work, they pay me money, I fix their toilet, and then I leave. So I think if we could sometimes just say, can I separate who I am from what I do? Because what I do is but a small part of who I am. And on my headstone, it's not going to say Tracy, exceptional PA podcast host, right? It's going to say beloved mother, wife, friend. It's going to say the ways that I showed up differently outside of medicine. Like they probably won't even remember that I worked in medicine at that point.
Correct. I think so often your purpose and your identity are tied to your career in medicine. And that's a wonderful thing. I like to think about that as a blessing, that there's not too many careers, as you use the plumber as an example, there's not a ton of careers where that naturally happens. So it's wonderful that we do have the opportunity to have that. But if you don't have that, that doesn't mean you're a failure. It doesn't mean that there's something wrong. It's completely fine to punch the clock and, you know, go work your shift, provide the best care that you can provide, and then go home and completely dissociate from your identity as a healthcare provider and find your meaning and purpose through other things. That's wonderful.
Yeah. And also, if you hate it, change something. So if you are in a terrible, toxic work environment, if you thought the specialty was going to be the be all end all, and you spent all of this time getting there and you got there and it feels like crap, don't stay. Life is too short to stay in a job that is just terrible and toxic. Like, just leave. You can find another job.
And there's enough demand in the PA field that you don't need to stay in jobs that are clearly toxic.
Yes. Yeah. So speaking of toxicity and the mental health load, I would love to get your take as someone who's doing what sounds like really cool mental health. Like I did not go on a rotation in mental health where we were doing what you are doing at work. But mental health visits have just increased year over year. They're climbing. We all know it because we're experiencing it. Our friends and patients are experiencing it. What is something or some things that you think that every listener who is maybe a non-psych provider should know? Give us a little crash course refresher. What are the do's, don'ts, and what do we need to be on the lookout for?
I think one of the most underappreciated aspects of mental health is wellness. And we talk about wellness a lot, but a lot of times it's associated with maybe, you know, essential oils or multi-level marketing. And there's a lot of aspects of wellness that are maybe more questionable in terms of empirical evidence, but there's a lot of aspects of wellness that have solid randomized controlled trials with really, really strong evidence. So when I talk to my patients, the thing that I always like to talk about is the core components of wellness. So sleep, exercise, diet, and then social connection. Those are the four things that through research, we know that if you're getting at least 8 hours of sleep, if you are exercising for at least 20 minutes a day, or ideally about 150 minutes a week of an elevated heart rate, and if you are eating fairly well, not any specific diet, but you know, Mediterranean, fresh foods, fresh vegetables, not eating excessively, eating only when your body's hungry, and then maintaining at least 20 to 30 minutes of social connection per day, which sounds easy for someone like you and I who have a million kids running around. But for a lot of people that live alone, especially in COVID, having human interaction is not always guaranteed. And I'm not counting work in that, in the sense that patient care is very different, you know, from true human interaction. But if you're doing those four things, almost all of them, there's independent research that shows that they outperform antidepressants. So that doesn't mean that we should, instead of giving someone an antidepressant, we should tell them to go for a walk every day, but rather that we should probably prescribe the antidepressant and continue to work hard to try and address lifestyle, just as we do with diabetes. If someone's diabetic, we don't say, I'm withholding insulin until you start exercising.
Get it together and then we'll
right.
treat you.
Yeah, exactly. No, we treat the hyperglycemia so that they don't die. And then we also continue to work on diet. We continue to work on exercise, those other aspects of lifestyle. So I think the big thing for me that I like to think about with mental health is that we actually have far more agency in our mental health than we like to think or like to ascribe. And whether that be us as PAs interacting and helping our patients, because every single PA treats mental health to some degree, regardless of specialty, you are seeing people that are depressed, you are seeing people that are struggling. So these little, you know, 5-minute visits, if you're in orthopedic surgery and you're talking to your patient about the importance of, you know, exercise, that has a mental wellness component to it. But even for us as healthcare clinicians, we know that mental health struggles, depression, and anxiety in the healthcare community is higher than the general population. Sadly, suicide rates within the healthcare community are quite prevalent. So it's not only something that we can give to our patients, but also something that we need to be doing as well. The old phrase, you know, physician heal thyself. I think it really is important that we're making sure that even if we're working 60, 70 hours because we're getting mandated overtime at the ER, whatever it may be, that we're still making time for those social connections, for 8 hours of sleep, decent food, and some level of exercise, whatever that may look like.
Most PAs bring home a decent paycheck, but aren't sure that they're investing enough or what approach to take for student loans. Caleb Pepperday is a certified financial planner who works specifically with APPs. Seeing that PAs, including his wife, were overlooked and physicians were treated with respect in the financial planning industry, he sought to rectify this mismatch by serving PAs with the excellence we deserve. Caleb's mission is to help make financial planning affordable for APPs regardless of their asset level. Head to advancedpracticeplanning.com and hit the schedule a conversation button to book your free consult. Your money is your largest wealth building tool, and failing to utilize it well could leave you wanting to retire without enough in your accounts or still having student loan payments when your kids are ready to attend college themselves. Caleb's clients can enjoy their money guilt-free while feeling confident in their savings and investments. Head to the show notes, tap the link, and call Caleb for your free consultation. On the call, Caleb will help you to determine whether his one-time or ongoing financial planning services are right for you.
Yeah, I think that makes such a big difference. In fact, I feel like anecdotally in my life, like this weekend in Pennsylvania, we got some snow. I took my kids skiing. I spent some time connecting with them, exercising, getting outside. Tonight, I'm hosting a book club for my girlfriends. Like, I can feel the difference in my own just like energy level in the way that I feel. Interviews like this, like when I have days that I just spend 8 hours working on content and emails, and it's not as exciting as pressing record and being able to have a conversation with someone. It definitely, I feel a lift when I'm doing those things. And I think, you know, all of us know that these are things that we should be doing, but we're not doing them. Yeah.
Yeah. It all feels very intuitive, and yet it's also very difficult. It's funny, right before we came on and pressed record, I was sitting here scarfing down McDonald's as I'm talking about how important the Mediterranean diet is. And yet every single healthcare provider knows that feeling, right? You know, anytime you go to a hospital, you see people, healthcare workers out back smoking. We all know what smoking does to you. And yet sometimes the path of least resistance is just the one that we take because we're tired, we're exhausted. But ultimately, you know, for long-term positive outcomes, that discipline, the self-care, it really does matter.
Yeah. I have recently really been thinking about the difference between knowing what to do and doing the actual thing. So, you know, if you gave us a multiple choice test, we would get those questions right. What lifestyle modifications improve, you know, anxiety, depression, mental health? We could guess, right? Even if no one had listened to the last 10 minutes of this podcast, we would be like, yeah, I think exercise is not going to make people feel worse, right? And then there's knowing and there's actually doing, and how can we implement these things as a part of our lives? Because everyone is busy and everyone has patients to see and things to do and other things that are, you know, on their list of things. So,
absolutely. I'm going to plug Outlived. So it's currently on the New York Times bestseller list. It's from Dr. Peter Attia, who's excellent. And he talks about a lot of this wellness stuff, that really exercise is one of the biggest modifiable risk factors that we have in our lives for living long and living healthy. But one of the things that he talks about that I think is wonderful, and if anyone listening to this is not familiar with the book, highly, highly recommend that you read it. It's very good. He talks about additive and subtractive behaviors, and that when you have an additive behavior where you're trying to add something into your daily life and make it into a routine, the best way to do it is to start very small so you don't get overwhelmed. So exercise, for example, and this is good for us as healthcare clinicians and for our patients, if we start our exercise regimen by saying, I'm going to run a 5K three times a week, and we've never run before in our life, the likelihood that we're going to achieve success doing that is probably pretty low. But if we say, I'm going to go for a 10-minute walk three times a week, we're going to build that routine. It's going to become incorporated in our daily routine and something that we become acclimated to. Once we've acclimated that into our routine, then we can start building up our tolerance for higher functioning. Say, okay, now I'm going to do a 15-minute walk. Now I'm going to switch to do a 15-minute run and slowly build from there. For subtractive behavior, where we're trying to eliminate things such as diet, we're trying to maybe eliminate carbs or eliminate alcohol. What we want to do is we don't want to put ourselves in a position where we have to rely on willpower and discipline. So with subtractive behaviors, we want to think about the environment that we're in and make sure that we are setting ourselves up for success. So a good example of that, maybe a little bit of a risque example, is if you're married, it's probably not a great idea to be drinking at the bar late at night surrounded by single people. You know, sure, people can do it, but why even put yourself in that situation where there may be untoward, you know, consequences or situations? So same type of thing with diet. If you are someone who is trying to cut back from a caloric restriction standpoint, then it's probably not going to be a great place to go out to dinner where everyone's getting steak and all that. Now, that doesn't mean stay at home and be a hermit, but be mindful of that, that the situation or the environment for subtractive behavior is really important.
Yeah. And Atomic Habits, the author of that one says, make it easy to do the thing that you want to do and make it hard to do the thing that you don't want to do.
Another great book. Yes.
Yes. So, you know, make it easy, set it up. And he even goes so far as to say, before you start exercising, spend a week where every day you put your sneakers on. That's the only, that's all that you could do. He's like, make it so simple that you can't fail. You just have to put your shoes on. And once you're in the habit of putting your shoes on, then you walk somewhere wearing those shoes. But first you have to put them on because you just really want to break it down. So it feels like you get those small wins at the beginning. Yeah. So I would love it if you would tell us, I feel like I see so many people who have gotten a DMSC. Tell us what it is not, and why you chose to pursue this of all of the choices of different kinds of degrees that you could have chosen.
It's such a great question. So I did my DMSC, I enrolled in 2019, and thankfully it actually worked out pretty well because the majority of my doctoral work was done during COVID. So I had lots of free evenings and nights, but so the story behind my DMSC is actually quite interesting. I've talked about it on my podcast. I was starting to get into industry consulting, and in 2018, I went to a steering committee meeting. So we were on a committee for a pharmaceutical company that helped them figure out, you know, marketing direction, educational priorities, priorities for future research, things like that. So the committee was, I think, 9 or 10 people, mostly physicians, and then they had a couple token PA and NPs there to have professional diversity. And there was another NP that was master's level, me as the only PA, and then there was a DNP there, so a doctorally trained NP, and she was academic, was not practicing clinically anymore. And throughout the meeting, you know, I would say my piece and they would nod politely, and the other NP would say their piece, and then they would turn and say to the doctorally trained NP and say, well, what do you think? And then she would say something, and it could be interesting or not that interesting, and they would just hang on every word. And at one point they said the quiet part out loud. They said, we are just so blessed to have a doctorally trained nurse practitioner as part of our committee, and it just is a testament to the level of expertise that we have brought into this room. And that was my light bulb moment, where it's like, okay, prior to that, I was not necessarily pro-doctorate because I didn't like the idea of just this continued degree inflation, where everybody is now having to get a doctorate just to keep up. And I thought that was silly. And then I realized that the doctorate is kind of your meal ticket to sit at the adult table. We operate in a world in healthcare where every other licensed profession is a terminal degree. Pharmacy, more and more NP is already getting there, but even audiology, physical therapy, occupational therapy, they're all doctorates. So it's really hard for us to say that we should have a seat at the table for decision-making or policy and really help shape the direction of healthcare when everyone else at the table is at a doctoral level and we are still master's trained. So I went to AT Still and I did healthcare leadership. I knew that I wanted to do something that was more focused on the business of medicine, since that's where kind of my career was pointing in terms of consulting and things like that. And it was awesome. I learned a ton. It definitely helped. You know, there were some really great medical economics courses, and I really did learn a lot about the operational side of healthcare. And healthcare is one of the largest industries in our economy. And yet so many people that work within that industry as clinicians have no exposure to the business side of it. And, you know, you don't have to be a greedy, money-hungry capitalist to appreciate that when you understand how the business of healthcare works, the business of medicine works, it can make you a better clinician because you're more informed of how the process works with insurance coverage, prior authorization, how medications are developed and approved. All of that can help make you a better clinician, even if it's just for patient care. So the program was awesome. It definitely helped. I was very careful in calculating my ROI. So I sat down and I looked at the cost of the program and then figured, is this something where I feel confident that if I incur additional educational costs, that I will get a sufficient return on investment? And I felt confident going in that I could. And then within 2 years of graduating with my doctorate, I had already paid it all back in the sense that all of my consulting contracts, I was able to successfully renegotiate those to higher levels because of the doctoral degree. I was able to demonstrate a level of expertise as an industry consultant because of the doctoral degree that then allowed me to get paid more. So it worked out well. I think for people that are interested in the DMSC, I actually love the DMSC because I think it's a really perfect, non-specific professional doctorate. If you are really, really interested in medical research, then go get your PhD. If you are really interested in becoming a professor and doing education, then go get your EdD. But if you are not sure what you want to do, but you think you want to advance, maybe you want to go into the non-clinical realm, whether that's administration, whether that's an MSL in industry, I think the DMSC is a great professional doctorate that is non-specific, but still gives us a little bit of a flavor and additional expertise and training that puts us on par with those other professions.
Yeah. I think that was a huge knowledge gap for me as a new provider. I graduated right around the same time as you. So 10 plus years into my career. And there were several times where an administrator looked at me and said, What are you even doing? How are we making money on you? And I was like, what am I doing? I'm running around like a chicken with my head cut off. Like, I have made this surgeon so much more, number one, liked, number two, profitable, but I didn't have any data to prove it because I didn't know what they were tracking or how they were billing or what was going in my bucket. I didn't even know I had a bucket. I was like, I have a bucket? Like, I should have been making sure my stuff was going in the bucket. And they were like, her bucket's overflowing. And last year it was only 50% full. And I was like, oh, I wonder why. I'm doing all the non-revenue generating work, but you haven't been tracking the revenue that I've been producing. And I sort of was like, I'm the provider. I don't need to know the business side. And then I thought, well, the business people don't know what I'm doing. So I guess I have to figure it out, right? I have to learn so that I can educate them about the value that I'm adding because they clearly don't know what I'm doing at all.
Yeah, it's so true. I think if you look at trends in physician compensation, most physicians get paid with some tie-in to productivity. And some of that is starting to shift because of changes to outcomes-based care instead of just fee-for-service, but it's still the majority of physician compensation does have some tie-in to how productive that person is. PA and NP is different. Historically, we were maybe seen more as staff and usually are almost exclusively salary-based without a tie-in. But the tides are starting to shift, and I believe NCCPA might have some data on this. I've seen it somewhere, but you are seeing year by year a growing proportion of PAs that are having productivity-based compensation. And I think that ties into exactly what you're describing, where if we are more informed of the value that we bring to an organization, if you are a rock star in surgery that, you know, is accounting for, what is it? I think 16% is of the surgery fee is the first assist. So if you're doing tons of procedures, but you are also doing all the preoperative and postoperative care, well, that's actually really easy to sit down and calculate because CMS, so Medicare, will actually break down what percentage of the global fee accounts for each part of that service. So you can sit down and actually figure out your value, even if it is falling under these global payments. When you know what value you bring to an organization, that's your negotiating tool. That allows you to go and say, okay, you know, a physician gets 60% of that, I want 50. And that's how you can really, from a clinical perspective, start to launch into those, you know, $200,000 plus rates of compensation that we're starting to see not become rarities, but, you know, that's something that we see encounter more frequently within the PA world.
Absolutely. And someone has to be the first. So I've been part of an organization that was this massive network, and I showed up and I was doing general surgery, and I said, what's the productivity bonus? You know, what's the comp structure for bonus based on how many cases I'm doing? I'm going to cover call, I'm going to be coming in. And they said, oh, we don't do that for surgery providers. We only do it for primary care providers. And I was like, well, I'm happy to be the first. I would love to build this with you, right? Like, let's figure it out. I have a model from what the, you know, a prior employer, we can apply that. We can look at what we do for the surgeons. And they were like, oh, okay. You know, I guess we could do it for, I don't know why we're not doing it for specialty care. And I was like, well, now's as good a time as any. Like, why don't we build it together? Because someone has to be the first one to get this compensation model. It didn't exist and now it does. So that could be you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think within that, my advice to listeners would be that if you want to break down doors or break glass ceilings within our profession, be really excellent at what you do. Be so valuable to your organization that you have the leverage to try and make big transformational changes. Because I think I've seen it often where you have people that will say, you need to pay me like this. And the response from the employer will be, okay, if you know, you can find a different job if you feel so strongly about that. So you need to position yourself where you can make a demand or you can make an ask like that, and they will consider it because you've demonstrated how valuable you are. And I think that's, it's so exciting to see, because more and more as PAs and NPs have greater autonomy and are filling roles that, you know, historically were done by physicians, but due to shortages, we're showing up and we're filling those roles and doing well. I think healthcare systems are starting to recognize how valuable we can be, in that, you know, all-star PAs and NPs should be compensated as all-stars, because that's always been the case for physicians. If you've got a physician that is just a rock star, they get paid like it because they're incredibly valuable to the system. Where a lot of times, I think even 15 years ago, if you had a PA that was just killing it, it didn't matter because they didn't recognize the value. Where now, if you are killing it, there's a higher likelihood that you're also going to be handsomely compensated as a result.
Yeah. And also other people notice that. Like, I have seen in my career, other people in adjacent specialties who knew of other rock stars before that rock star wanted a job in that department. So that reputation will precede you anywhere you go and anything that you do. And, you know, anything worth doing is worth doing well. So if you're going to have that job, you might as well
be excellent in everything you pursue. That's what my grandparents always used to say.
Awesome. So this has been super fun. If people are like, I need more of Mike in my life, where can they find you? What is your podcast? Tell us all the places that people can find you and connect.
Yeah. So I run a company called White Coats of the Round Table, and we do a podcast. We do a newsletter. We are gearing up to do some more educational content. So 2024 will be a fun year for that, but you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm very active on LinkedIn. I always love hearing from people. So if you send me a message, I will respond back pretty promptly because I have a LinkedIn addiction maybe. So definitely look me up on LinkedIn and check out our podcast, White Coats of the Round Table, on all major streaming platforms.
Awesome. Well, Mike, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy day and schedule to be with us today. I'm really excited to share this episode with our listeners.
Thanks, Tracy. It was a lot of fun, and thank you for having me.
These conversations feel so life-giving to me. They remind us that the possibilities are truly limitless, that there are ways to expand your income and your impact and your fulfillment inside of work or outside of what you're doing professionally, that there are many avenues open to you, and that if you want to further your education, you absolutely can do that. But without going back to school, that you still have this ability to expand your knowledge base and use those skills in a way that add value to other people. Thank you, as always, for tuning in to another episode of The PA Is In. This PA is out. Congratulations, you've just joined an awesome club. By listening to a full episode of The PA Is In, you are officially on the Unicorn PA team. Welcome aboard. What most team members do is they subscribe to the podcast because that allows them to automatically get the latest episode of the show. The life of your dreams exists on the other side of taking action. Keep making small shifts and keep getting better.
Your life will improve, your career will soar, and you will have the confidence you need to create your own success. I will see you in the next episode. This PA is out.